So, Michael is going to talk to us about software model checking and Debian.
All right, thank you. So, I think my screen is slightly skewed, which is because I'm using a non-free OS here, so I can't even fix it. So that's all my fault. What I'm going to talk about is work that I've started about a year ago, and that's still only starting to take off and probably might be finished 10, 20 years from now. I don't actually expect that to be done earlier. But still, I'll give you an idea of what we can do currently, what I think is useful, and what's going to happen. I also dare to do a short introduction of myself, because I'm not sure I've met any of you before today, even, yeah, but I might be the only one. And I've been at ED since about 6 years, and my contributions, well, you can find them now on contributors.debian.net, .org, sorry. Mainly I'm focusing on package maintenance that's sort of related to my work. So I'm an academic now in London. Some of that is, I've started out with maintaining BrickOS packages and GCC for the H8300 processor. And now I'm also maintaining SAT solvers and in particular a model checker called CBMC. Which I'm going to talk about a bit in this talk. I did a bit of work for doing mentoring and sponsorship. Mostly did so and not doing so right now because time just doesn't really permit. But that's still an area of interest to myself. Overall, my main interests are in improving software quality. So what I'm doing in my professional and fun life is developing tools to analyze software. So I'm writing software to analyze software, which clearly relates a lot to test automation. So David and Lars have started this, and I'm going to pick up various bits from your talk in the next slides. The driver for all this is in some parts my work, but also more the passion for quality. So sometimes I might be going to the extremes, and I will, in the end, ask you for comments in that regard, whether I'm too far. So starting out with something very trivial for all of you. Most of you will know about double sort, I guess, and you surely know how to write the correct version of that. Here's one. Unfortunately, it's just almost correct. It was written by a colleague of mine. Now you might make all kinds of claims about him. He just typed it off of a book. So it shouldn't be all that far from working version. So what does it do? It takes an array of integers, say five of them. The second parameter is then the size of that array. And the output should be a sorted array. So we've got 1, 3, 4, 6, and 6. That's the intended operation of the algorithm. So what do we do? Well, we want to find out if we did correct, so we will test it. In order to test that, we'll write a first printing, well, the inputs and then the output, and we'll look at it whether these match, and we might automate that check. Do so, we'll put in five elements, and then we can run it. I'm not sure this is probably not visible on that screen, unfortunately. So what I'm doing here is I just compile this code using GCC. I run it. It's now concrete input, so I run it and I can just look at the output. Actually, I've also put in an assertion, so this automatically checks whether my output was sorted, and it tells me, well, it is not. There's a bug I'll show on the next slide. So I'll just skip that because you can't see it anyway. So there's a simple typo here where it says J smaller or equal to 1. well, that should be an I instead. Stupid typo, actually hard to see without testing, but okay, fixable. Now our algorithm is perfect, of course. But still, I'll take it to the next level, which is automated testing. So just let's do a bit more testing. Again, some people might be able to see, that is probably not because the screen doesn't do what it should. So we can, there are tools that automatically generate test inputs for you, possibly even giving you some sort of coverage of your code. And then you can run these test inputs and observe that actually there's another bug. So it shouldn't be J equals 2, but instead we should start from 1, so actually start from the right element to be sorted. That's another bug fixed, and if we now run it, test it again on a number of inputs, we will see that it seemingly works fine. So I cannot find the bug anymore by testing, it seems. Except, on those 5 elements. After all, I mean, whether we sort 5 elements or 10 elements or whatever, it should be correct. I'll just tell you, yeah, there's the input and there's the correctly sorted output. So we're done. Except that if I change the size of my array from 5 to something that's beyond the page size, then suddenly I get a segmentation fault. So that's the first sorting algorithm that's sensitive to the size. That's clearly another bug to be fixed. So it just ran over the bounds of my array, and as long as it stayed within one page, it didn't really show up as an error. So what I could do instead of testing this and maybe finding the bug or not, I can do something that is called model checking. Who in the audience has heard of model checking before? Well, there's a couple of people, that's nice. So model checking can give us a few more guarantees than testing. Well, in principle, it's intended as a method to actually obtain proofs of correctness of our code, and that's a key feature. So you will either get a proof, or it will tell you, no, there's a bug, and you will also get a counterexample. So it will not just say, no, there's something wrong. It will really give you a concrete trace that leads to an error, so you can use that to debug your code and fix the error. So doing that, we can actually show that this is, at least with respect to out-of-memory errors and for the sorting property, now correct. And now it's concretely executing, takes a while, and seems to be fine now. So that was just bubble sort, and arguably, that's something you might trust, that you can either take it off of a working library or something else. Testing does work reasonably well in such sequential contexts, but I will now give you another example, a very trivial one. It's a concurrent program. So I've got 2 functions that I'll execute in 2 threads, spawned here using pthread create. They are utterly simple. So we've got shared variables x and y, and also r1, r2, which we'll just use to communicate the output values. And we assign 1 into x and y here in those 2 threads. Now, if you think of what could happen in the end, so when we execute that program, and we've got here now got a test that it is impossible that both r1 and r2 take the value 1 in the end. Or have the value 1 at the same time. So, well, how could that possibly be? For that to take the value 1, that has to be 0 plus 1, so y has to take the value 0. Therefore, this part has not yet been executed. If we get here, x has to take the value 1, so if we execute that later on, then we've got y equals 1, and x now already has the value 1, so 1 plus 1, this is 2. So, and initially we've got all of them to 0, so both of them taking the value 1, that's just impossible. It's dangerous in here. Okay, so that's simple, but if you actually run it on your computer, these days most of them might be multi-cores, you will see that this assertion fails. Actually, it's worse. It sometimes fails. So that's really a bigger practical problem. It is very hard to reproduce that error. If you're writing that kind of software, shipping it off to a customer, they might come back to you with, hey, this fails. And then you try to reproduce it on your site. You might or might not manage. Then you start editing your code, and then it doesn't appear anymore. So you fixed it. Maybe, probably, maybe not. So I've recently talked to people in IBM here in Hursley who've got whatever large communication system using quite a lot of concurrency. They do also see these errors cropping up at some customer side, try to reproduce them, might manage to change their code a little bit, and yeah, maybe it's fixed. And then a year later or so, the bug crops up again, and nobody knows what's happening. So those of you, and as we are on an ARM side here, who have worked with processors at that level will know that, everybody knows that processors have caches and instruction pipelines these days, and what that causes, and in order to make all that efficient, is something that people refer to as weak memory models. So you do not actually get all these guarantees that you, or the, some of the assumptions that you're making, they don't really hold on these systems. And that's a point where model checking could come into play, because it can really give you a proof that there is no error of this kind, or else it can give you a counterexample showing how such an error might manifest. Whereas this is extremely hard to reliably produce using testing. So what is software model checking at the high level about? So in model checking, we've got a specification. Usually in software verification, that will be really an. So some of you maybe sometimes write assertions in their code. Would be nice if more people did. But reality isn't always nice. And at the conceptual level, we have some model, which for us really is the source code. And then we have a fully automatic method that tells us whether our specification is fulfilled, saying yes, and there is no way our specification could ever be violated, or it says no, and we get a counterexample. So that's a trace leading to a violation of that specification. In practice, there are a few challenges. So one is the undecidability of the problem, so there cannot actually be such a method. Or not a reliable one. So in reality, you will often see, the tool just doesn't return either in the time you gave it or you run out of memory and such issues. So what software model checking currently works for is usually fairly small examples, so up to a few thousand lines of code. And in practice, unfortunately, most tools don't really work for what we would consider software. Because it's still a fairly academic situation. So we've got 10, 15 tools maybe around, and most of these tools wouldn't really be able to parse most of real-world code. So there is a lot of work left to be done. Fortunately, I'm in a situation in working with people in the group who have a technically relatively stable tool, but still, of course, we need to put more work in there. And that's also how these things now start fitting together and why Debian is so useful for me in this particular context even. So just to show you what's happening, so maybe this is now more readable with a white background. So we can run the bounded model checker called CBMC on that small example that I had on the previous slide, and it is going to tell us verification successful if I take as memory sequential consistency, which is really just interleaving, so there's no weak memory model effect in there. If, however, I tell the same tool to go for a memory model called TSO, so total store ordering, originally conceived by Sun, and that's what x86 processors implement these days, then the model checker will come back to me on the same example, but just different memory model, and give me a counterexample trace. So a counterexample trace is really a sequence of assignments that tell you, okay, here is, in the end, there's the assertion, which is violated, and it's violated through these steps here. So on a reasonably small example, you can quite easily follow that. Here it's only 25 steps, so you can usually understand what's going on and thereby try to fix, well, follow what happened in your software and then also fix your software. So just to strengthen my point why this could be useful in practice, not only on very small examples, here's a piece from an exchange on the PostgreSQL mailing list, started in 2010. There was a discussion of possibly errors cropping up under weak memory models, so that was in November 2010. Then in August 2011, same guy said, yes, this really seems to be an issue after doing I don't know how much research. And if I just yesterday check Git for that respective code, it still says there ought to be a memory barrier in here. So actually they know that there is a problem. And it only crops up if you run this RPC 8-core machine. Sometimes, of course, only. And they haven't really fixed it yet because they're not sure how to do it. So you've got an idea what should be happening, but it's not all that straightforward. What is the most efficient fix? What is actually correct? Because testing, again, doesn't work very well. So what we managed to do is not only reply to that, but also reply to that saying that, okay, we know where to put the memory barriers, and we know which one to pick. So LWSync is something that exists only on PowerPC. ARM has related memory barriers. For non-ARM, non-PowerPC, you wouldn't actually need any barriers. So you can do all these proofs on the actual source code using our tool. We're trying to start helping the community with our tools. And hopefully, over time, we will actually be able to do that on more software and produce more feedback. So that's the one direction of why software model checking could be useful for software at large, Debian in particular. But it's also, fortunately, going the other direction, that Debian appears to be incredibly useful to improve our tools. And because what we can do right now is smallish examples. So for instance, we've also done the proof on a part in the Linux kernel, which really requires a particular memory barrier on PowerPC. And similarly, it will be the case on ARM. And we can prove that this memory barrier is essential there. If you omit, you can actually get an error. So we can do some of the, well, look at some parts of the Linux kernel to do useful stuff. But really, what we ought to do is a lot more experiments and experiments at much larger scale. Our academic community doesn't really do that right now. Most papers people publish will have 3-4 experiments with some handwritten benchmarks, which, okay, that's what people can do apparently, but we, if we really want to produce something for a wider audience, for any developer out there, then it really ought to be tools that just work at large scale and work on real software. So the main challenge is also how to automate these experiments, because if we want to do large scale experiments with millions of lines of code, then we better ought to automate these. And that's really why it's so great to have a nice and big distribution. And that's really the enabling technology to make that poll. So apparently, according to a study in 2012, and I could also do this on my setup now, we've got around 400 million lines of code in Wheezy. And what makes it even more interesting for us is that we've got a fairly broad range of ports. So we've got different NDNS, we've got, and when you go for concurrency, different memory models. And that's apparently all supported by our source packages, at least most of them. And we can then try to do experiments. So in order to automate that, automate experiments on that many million lines of code, we crucially rely on a uniform build system. Now, me telling you this, this is all, well, trivial for you. But that's really a key step, because if I went to source, I could go and download each software package, figure out how to build it, maybe try to put in my stuff. Well, of course, that's one of the key contributions that Linux distributions have made, that we can just do that automatically and I can just run it. Plus, we've also got some recent and some very useful infrastructure, such as sources Debian.net. I suppose most of you will know about that. And then we can do such funny things as doing an experiment. We've just compiled documentation about that 2 months ago, where we analyze around 200 million lines of code. So actually just the C code that we have in Debian, and try to find issues, well, potential issues with weak memory models. And we looked at around 1,500, 1,600 packages. Now, of course, that's all automatic, as is obvious for you, but that's far from obvious for most of our community. And that's really a big gain for us. This now lists some results that we have in the Apache web server. And thanks to sources Debian.net, we can now also just put links in there and immediately link what we find as candidates for errors in the source code to source code with marks in here that might help developers or whoever cares about that identify possibly critical parts of their code. So the developers might be aware of that and might be able to tell you, no, that's fine, that's made safe by other means, or they might go and fix it. So that's recent work that's really now enabled by such a nice distribution, and that's using the infrastructure that I'll now talk about. So what we do as first step, what we have to do for our analysis, is compiling all the packages. Now, we can't compile them to binaries. We need to compile them to our own intermediate representation. So those of you who know about Clang LLVM, they have their own bytecode. We use the intermediate representation. And we've got a tool called GoToCC, which is part of the CBMC source package. And that can be in place of GCC, so it takes the same command line options. And instead of compiling to an object file and eventually then producing executable, we have a file containing all the intermediate representation that we can then pass on to, say, a model checker. And other things we can do, so it's becoming sort of a fun code management framework. We can also take that code, take that intermediate representation, and dump it again as C code, human readable C code. So we put some effort in there to analyze the code and turn it back into something that's useful. Initial experiments that I've done so far were based on, well, I just started out from documentation provided by Uwe Herrmann, a script that's actually now part in the pbuilder package. So I use Calder and pbuilder, which does have some issues with some of the packages, but that mostly works. In the change route, I replace GCC and LD by a script, which I'll talk about in a minute. And I can then run multiple builds in parallel. Unfortunately, in this setup, even though I can mostly do it using sudo, sometimes I need to have root access to debug what's going on. That's primarily an issue with pbuilder that I, some packages not behaving nicely, running test suites that don't actually stop and just continue running beyond the build process. Tried to file bugs for these, but there are still a few of them left. The scripts I've initially used and some documentation is on a GitHub repository of mine. It's all pretty much straightforward, but it's becoming useful. So what's happening in there is that GoToCC builds this intermediate representation. It builds a binary containing the intermediate representation. What it then does, and I'll talk about that towards the end, it also does link time type checking, which is something that you cannot actually do if you compile to object code, because object code doesn't actually, well, usual object code, ELF objects don't have type information anymore. And that turns up a lot of bugs that you might not find otherwise. So we first run GCC or LD as usual in this script, parse a few of the command line options, for instance, minus O, of course, to find what the output file is. And then we put in that same output file another ELF section that contains our intermediate representation. This hack is necessary to work with various build environments, which for one first build code that they then later execute. So we've still got an executable. And it's also necessary in all build environments that move around files, which say if, as soon as you use libtool or so, then your files will be moved around. So to successfully build, we need to make sure we either track all these moves or just have all our information in one source file. So I said we've got a file now with an additional ELF section that remains executable and can, whatever the build system might do, we can keep going. Some issues that we have right now is, first of all, I've so far only replaced GCC, not and really only that file that via alternatives is resolved from GCC and not G++. So we do not currently do sufficient C++, and also we do not support nested functions. So there still appear to be quite a few files that use GCC's extension of nested functions. Clang, I think, is not willing to support that, so I'm not sure. Maybe some people will start editing their code to get rid of these. Out of all the packages at the moment, around 700 or so fail, probably a larger fraction of these because of bugs in our tool chain, but quite a few of them also because we report errors that GCC couldn't report. As an improvement that I would like to see at some point, because we put our extra ELF sections in there, when we compile the final Debian package, we've actually got files in there with all our extra code. So if these were library packages and we later on link against these, then we could also link against our own sections in there. That's something we're not currently doing. So I'm just using pbuilder with the usual resolver, and it will download all the build dependencies from Debian mirrors rather than using our locally built ones. If we fix that, then we would have even more checking. also running a sort of self-check, dumping again the C code. So we compile the intermediate representation, which simplifies all control flow structures to go-tos. So it'll be hardly readable, hardly human readable code, but it's very easy to automatically manipulate. It maintains various original source information, so it doesn't have mangled names or anything. And we can then dump this again in fairly readable C code. A few changes, of course, but we can restore various loops, various switch case. We get if and else back and such. And what I'm trying to do is run this in a loop, so compile it, dump it, compile it, and so forth, and see that that actually exists. Anything else is a bug in one of our tools. We do note a couple of errors in compiling it once, dumping it again. That's fine. But then trying to compile again, we note that some functions are not properly declared. That usually stems from missing include files. So for various more or less built-ins, people that don't seem to use the right include files, is accepted by GCC, even though there are various warnings. We currently fail on that. So there's a lot of room for cleaning up the code. But I'm not sure whether I should dare to report bugs on these, because most developers will probably not care. But it would be nice if that were fixed. So in terms of improving code quality, there's a lot of room and very easy to address stuff. Could we get a mic?
Just from the history of how GCC has been developing, as I've seen it as a developer of libraries and other C applications in Debian, those kinds of missing include files, it's probably better to put in wishlist on minor bugs now, because future versions of GCC are probably going to actually complain about it. And at that point, it becomes failed to build open source, and that becomes RC. So if you know that these things are missing, even if they don't break the GCC build in 4.6, 4.7, 4.8, eventually they'll probably break it. So, yeah.
Not sure whether I need to announce a bug filing for that. So. I might actually end up reporting roughly half the packages or so. So it is a large number. So the initial one was just based on a couple of scripts. And I then moved on to using Jenkins. So that has been mentioned by David and Lars before. I'm not sure it is the best solution in the end. So those of you who don't know Jenkins, that's roughly what it looks like. Can also, I'll be happy to give you a live demo if time permits. So you've got a list of packages. This is now, probably in the back down there, you can't actually read it. This is now just a section, packages starting with the digit, just to have a small selection. It is very important to group these into views, because displaying the full list of Debian packages, so all the jobs, which is around 17,000, will take forever in your browser. And I'm fortunate enough that I got this machine, which has 16 gigabytes of memory, so I can actually display those pages. The JavaScript that Jenkins delivers to your browser will make it crank if you have some, if you don't have more than 4 gigabytes of memory, then you cannot actually load these pages. So there is a lot of room for improvement in Jenkins. And don't dare to load these pages if you have a fairly large build queue active. Now, if you try to build all your Debian packages, then you've got 17,000 entries in there. So you better wait for a week or so for that to get smaller. Otherwise, it won't deliver the page to your browser, even on a powerful machine. So it's nice in many ways, but yeah, it's just not really the perfect solution. So I started this, as I said before, about a year ago. So back then, there hadn't Debil hadn't existed until then, so that now exists and might be an alternative solution. I'm not sure it's the right solution. So, of course, there are a number of advantages of using Jenkins, and those of you who use it will probably like it because it's very easy to set up. You just install the Debian package. There's a huge collection of plugins. Some of them are very useful. Some of them are even essential in this context. So one that I'm using is the job DSL plugin, so you can write a job that creates all the other jobs. Obviously, I didn't sit down and write 17,000 job descriptions, but you just use one job to generate another 17,000 for any of the tools you run. There's something like Bulk Builder, so you can select the number of packages you want to build using regular expressions. You can then click through all the failed builds and put claims in there, so tell them, okay, I know why this is broken. And master-slave support, quite important to achieve scalability. And important in our academic context, maybe not so much in many other contexts, it's also usable by non-tech users. So just because you're in computer science doesn't mean that people actually know how to operate a computer. So that's nice to have a web page where people can just click around. And of course, any results you have are immediately publicly available. On the downside, the scalability, as I did mention, so we're now doing just the builds and trying to dump them back as C code. So there's two basic jobs, but multiplying that by the number of packages that we have, we end up with something like 36,000 jobs, which is far beyond anything that Jenkins can handle while remaining responsive. So you can imagine that just starting Jenkins, reading all the job descriptions, so it stores all of them as XML files, takes currently for me, I think, around 10, 15 minutes or so. Reasonable because you don't restart Jenkins that many times. Well, unfortunately, you actually have to because it just crashes from time to time. So, it's a Java web application. It's extensible in some ways. Whether it's beautiful code or not, I'll leave it to the taste of everyone. And as I said, in order to view some of these pages, you really need a powerful machine, which is really not what you would want. Currently in my setup, it uses around 17 gigabytes, so just the server running, not actually doing anything. this might not scale to everyone's setup. It gave me an easy start because it was easy to set up, but I think over the next few months, that will probably have to be replaced by something else. Observations I made while running these experiments. Verbose build logs would be very useful. So there has been a couple of discussions in recent time. What happens is I run those tools, I run my tools, which are also still experimental, and they might break for one reason or the other. So I would really like to see, okay, what was the command line that the compiler was called with, or the linker even. And then if I just see CC and the file name, that doesn't get me anywhere. So what I have to do, I have to get in Intrud and run it manually, turn on verbose, and just a lot more manual work. But another bigger issue is reporting bugs. So I'll give you a couple of examples of bugs that I discovered while doing these experiments. So genuine errors in the packages. I did find loads of bugs in our own tools, but also in the packages that we're building. So question one is, okay, what do people accept as a bug that relates to, for instance, missing include files? Will people hate me for filing such a bug, or will they actually at least accept that? And the bigger practical problem, the bugs that I'm seeing are, in almost all cases, upstream errors. So I should really go and report these errors with upstream rather than the Debian bug tracking system. But I really love the Debian bug tracking system because it works very well. And it's really, really cumbersome to go to all these. So I, up to date, I think, filed around 200 bugs or so. And each of them is, well, manually inspected. And so I really tried to understand what was going wrong, possibly even giving an idea of how to fix it. But then also, I usually would have to register with some upstream bug tracking system, or just hope that there exists a mailing contact. Some of these are then dead, so there's quite a few dead upstreams. So, well, I ended up filing at least half of them or so with our BTS instead. Haven't heard that many complaints about it, but I understand that it's actually not right. Well, I'm wondering what scalability-wise the best approach is. So, there's a couple of bugs on our BTS, SourceForge. Okay, I'm registered there. I've got a GitHub account. So a couple of them are, I accept that I can with relative ease deal with these, but random bug tracker of dollar project is a bit hard. So what errors have I actually seen, and why are they useful and more than what, say, GCC gives you? All the following five that I'll show relate to link time type checking. So we've got our files, we've got all the object files, and are you trying to tell me something up there? got the object files, each of them compiled fine. Maybe there were some GCC warnings, don't know. And then we try to link them. So when we, in the end, probably a few years from now, really want to do something like formal software verification, like model checking can provide, then it is essential that what we are trying to check also has a well-defined semantics. So if we're trying to check software that uses different types for the same variable, then there's nothing we can really check about it because the behavior of that is not defined. The most common case that I've seen so far, and maybe I'll probably have 50 or so reported of these, and I've just over the last night seen another 50 to 100 of these, which I haven't yet reported. It's just differences in signedness. So one file declaring a global variable as unsigned, the other one declaring it as a signed integer. Whether that actually causes an error or not depends on the values that are stored. If they never go beyond maximum signed integer, positive one, and it's all positive, then you won't actually see an error in this case. So I tend to report them, but I have to admit that it might not cause genuine errors, but do so in future. Now looking at another package, I've seen the same variable once declared as a signed integer and then as a character of 41 bytes. Seeing the difference of those types, most likely just someone not knowing that that variable already exists in a different file. And maybe it doesn't have any consequences, or it does, I don't know. But that the difference in these types clearly looks like it was unintentional. It can get worse. You've got a signed integer versus an unsigned character, so these differ in byte size. And if you go to a big endian system, then this might mess up quite heavily. So even if you don't overflow the size of an unsigned character, it will just be in the wrong bytes. So that will inevitably go wrong, I'd say. Here's another nice one. An array declared of a signed integer, well, 641 elements of signed integers and 641 shorts. So you can nicely write and read from that array at a certain position in each of those files, but unfortunately it will be off by half your index. So I think this will necessarily go wrong, assuming that those pieces of code are somehow interacting. And one of the worst ones probably is what I've just seen in XRDP. I haven't even filed that yet. A variable declared with some largest structure. It's once declared as this struct type and once as a pointer to the struct type. So whichever way you use that, you're going to read the first index as the address, or so if you dereference that, you're just going to take whatever in that character array is as an address, and so that will take you anywhere. All bets are off. On the other hand, if you store the pointer, you'll have some very interesting listen address, so I'd rather not want to know what's going to happen there. This might well be a security issue. I do not yet know what's going on there. I haven't yet looked at that in detail. On the other hand, there are also link errors reported right now, which probably are safe. So there's one file declaring a structure, so don't worry about that's just the internal name that we generate because it's an anonymous struct. And here's a union that contains this structure and has something else. So that is likely safe because bytewise it will be the same, but these are different types. So if you had both of them in one C file, the C standard says you must not do that. But I accept that this will probably not be an error. So that takes me essentially to my almost last slide. First of all, what I do not know, and maybe someone else can comment on that, is what the best specification of what correct linking is. I have a C standard, and I can look up things in the C standard, but the C standard won't talk about link because that's beyond the scope. I don't really know what documentation I could consult with to see which guarantees any linker should provide. And I just gave you examples of bugs that I've seen. So these were actually bugs that I've seen just walking through the failed builds last night. I haven't yet reported these. So for anything I have reported so far, I went to the source code. I'll get to you in a second. I went to the source code, really tried to check twice that what our linking tool reports, because it's a prototype, it's still experimental, is actually genuine and is really an error. So that involved quite a few manual steps, and doing that at a larger scale is, well, it just takes time. I'm okay doing it, but making that more efficient would be nice. And there is my question is, do you, I think this is useful, that's why I started it. But whether people agree that this is useful, I don't know. So I'm happy to answer questions and other questions. Thank you.
I think the best dynamic linking is Ulrich Treppe's DSO how-to at the moment. Okay. Which everybody should have read anyway.
What plans do you have for languages other than C?
One that has time and energy to write up code up the front end, that'd be appreciated. So I'm trying to persuade a PhD student of mine to maybe look into Python. I should go one step back. So the framework we have has this intermediate representation, which is independent of the input language. So what you need to do is write the parser, so the grammar, and do the type checking, and then the conversion, which should be very straightforward once you've got the parser right, to the intermediate language. And then you get various benefits. So you, all the linking and such, they're all at the level of the intermediate language. We would also then have transformations from one language to the other, because we could just listen and dump C. That'd be fine. And possibly also the other way around, because even the dumping code is sort of modular. So it really just requires time and energy. So we've got a C++ front end, but that doesn't yet cope with all the template mess. We know that not even all the standard compilers support all the C++ standard features, but we are not as far as, say, GCC is. So C is, I'd say, complete, except for nested functions, which we'll probably just never support. C++ lacks some template magic, but unfortunately, still as much as you need in order to parse standard template libraries. So that's just a key step that requires more work. We've got some preliminary work on PHP and Java, it would be a lot of fun to extend that to other languages, and in particular scripting languages, I think that.
Okay, and key question for me, as someone who has some C source code as an upstream that happens to be in a package in Wheezy, where can I find out whether or not I cocked up?
I haven't really shown, I'm not sure, will the slides be made available I've made various pictures in their link, so you can just click on that. Our Jenkins server is publicly available. I just haven't yet announced this anywhere else, apart from here. you can take a look in there. What fails, you can. I've now put all the claims for all the failing builds in there, so it already has a comment if it fails, and if it succeeds, then that's fine.
And I have one final question, which is, as someone who's using Wheezy and wants to potentially test new code I write, are there convenient packages that I can install to get all of the tools to be able to do this?
All you'd need is a script that's on my GitHub repository, and that actually downloads all the... It would install CowBuilder, PBuilder. It sets up the change route, replaces the GCC by script, so it would do all this with just one execution of the script. So in principle, yes. But you would want to look at the script, of course.
Have you tried this with the kernel yet?
The Linux kernel is just one package. Yes. And we do compile the Linux kernel. That compiles fine.
And what did he get?
Pardon?
What did he see?
I think the Linux compiles fine, so I didn't see any of the errors. That doesn't mean that it's bug-free, of course, but what we've found so far, what I've done in this work, really with these experiments, we've only done the compilation, so we just know, okay, so it seems to be fine as far as types go. We haven't really done, except for experiments I mentioned in the beginning, we haven't yet done any large-scale model checking efforts on this.
For the results you've shown us a few example errors. How feasible would it be to classify the errors into severity and likelihood so that you could maybe do automatic bug filing?
I think it should be relatively straightforward. I've done some of this before, not now in my Jenkins setup, but with the previous scripted one that I had. Because the error messages are consistent, so okay, there's conflicting types here. And then probably looking at the types, the string output of the types, you could classify them, okay, if it's just signed versus unsigned, but otherwise of the same type, then it's likely not that bad. If they are far off, then yes, you might report something of higher severity. And in particular, I guess, if it's pointer versus non-pointer. So only seen two cases of that. So one the XRDP and another one that I've already filed. So there were a struct was part of into a function and a pointer was expected. So yeah, that I guess could go horribly wrong.
Cool.
What? Last question.
Oh, sorry. As far as filing the bugs is concerned, I mean, you're testing on a Debian base, you're using some packages, if not the package you're looking at, those packages are going to have patches from Debian in their build and that sort of thing. I don't see why it should be a problem to use the BTS for all of the bugs, really. You are testing Debian base, and it's up to the maintainer to actually send that back up to upstream and forward and stuff. It shouldn't be a problem, I would have thought, for most maintainers to have a bug reported that is, yes, it's clearly upstream, but actually it needs to come via Debian to make sure that it is, isn't being introduced by something else in Debian, not necessarily in that packet.
So I like your position, and but it makes things a lot easier for me, and it's also as taking the maintainer perspective, I'm completely fine taking reports which are actually upstream because I know whom to contact, so that's easy enough for me. But I don't know whether everyone agrees. So.
Cool. Well, thank you very much, Michael. I think we do have a few more people who'd like to talk to you, but we've run out of time for the talk, so if you want to grab Michael afterwards. Thank you very much. That was great.